Let's hear more about the games themselves from someone who covered them for National News.
The more than 20,000 law enforcement officials that will meet here in Atlanta will finally get to put their strategies to the test on July 19th, when the Summer Centennial Olympic Games begin. I'm Kathy Lohr in Atlanta.
Kathy Lohr sounds a little different now.
Wow.
She's a reporter with NPR in the summer of 1996. Welcome, modern Kathy.
Great to be here, Sloan.
So at this point in time, when we think of the Olympics in Atlanta, we connect the two. That's natural. But before Atlanta got the Olympic Games, people would not have made that connection. Can you give me an idea of how surprising this was?
I think Atlanta was still thought to be a small southern town. I mean, they were perhaps better than some of the Birmingham or those kind of southern cities that had the racist history. But Atlanta was not seen as a mover and shaker, I don't think, in the national perspective. And I think that this getting the Olympics was this combination of Billy Payne and Andrew Young and some other true movers and shakers in Atlanta saying, look, we can do this and we need this. This is going to catapult Atlanta into a mega city. We're going to get population. We're going to be, I think Atlanta had a little bit of a complex that it wasn't as good as other places. And this is going to give us that.
Well, let's bring in one other voice that can help us get this context. Maurice Hobson is an assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. He's also author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. Thanks for being with us.
Hello, it's good to always be here.
So add your voice into this. Just how shocking was this?
It was extremely shocking, partially because of the calculated steps that the white business elite and the black political kingmakers took to create or to fortify the image of Atlanta as the city too busy to hate.
So once the city got over its initial shock, obviously this was a huge achievement for the people who were on the organizing committee. It was a huge achievement for those people who had hosted Olympic officials in their homes. So what was then the reaction of people in Atlanta? Because we know today, decades later, you know, everyone in Brazil wasn't happy about having the Olympics in Rio. But that it was a different situation for Atlanta at the time, was it not?
I mean, people were thrilled to have the Olympics here. It was a time of really city pride, spirit. Everybody was excited about the venues. They had created these new venues that, for the most part, were hopefully not going to disappear, were going to be thought of not as a Los Angeles, where they would remain instead of being a white elephant, basically. Mm-hmm. And people were excited about having all these people coming into the city to see Atlanta, that Atlanta would be this spark. It was a sparkling moment.
Yeah, and viewership at those times has not declined of the Olympics as it has in recent years, Maurice. So at this point, and as we even as we got further in, would you say that the excitement sustained all the way up through the Olympics, and most of the criticism came after?
Well, I think the excitement was sustained by particular class groups, but I want to say this: the thing about Atlanta hosting the Olympics had a lot to do with the fruition or the manifestation of Dr. King's dream. So the conversation around when Maynard Jackson, when the group went to Tokyo when they won the bid for the game, is that they had a scheme to where there was a lineup. Joe Frank Harris spoke, the governor, Joe Frank Harris spoke, Billy Payne spoke, Maynard Jackson spoke, and then Andy was to play cleanup.
Andrew Young, right.
Andrew Young was to play cleanup. And so what happens with this is Maynard Jackson always thought of himself as a minister, and particularly coming out of the Baptist church. And they did this to where they played this Olympic song, and then Ambassador Young brings it home. And it's almost like what they call in the black church whooping. It's like when he gets up and he really kind of, you know, really makes it happen. And it moved people to tears, because when they saw Andrew Young, understanding that he was a lieutenant of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this was Dr. King's dream manifesting. And so what we begin to see with the Olympics was a way, particularly in the American South, where white business and black politicians were able to come together and really show the progress of the American South.
And we've mentioned Maynard Jackson before. Just as a reminder, he was the first African-American mayor of Atlanta, and actually of any major city in the South. Mm-hmm. And so, Kathy, you were covering this for a national, actually international network. And I guess I should ask, were there assumptions made that Atlanta would not be ready? Did people have stereotypes stuck in their head about how well prepared Atlanta was to become an international city?
I think Atlanta did not. It was people from the outside who viewed Atlanta as maybe, you know, gosh, will they ever make this happen? Not to the extent that we see today, but it was, you know, will they be ready? How are they going to deal with this major traffic issue? In fact, most people that were Atlantans who lived here told me they were leaving the city for the 2 weeks this was going to happen, a little over that, because they didn't want to deal with the traffic. And most of the businesses shut down. Some of them had night hours. Deliveries were made by UPS and others at night. And actually, it turned out to be the easiest time to get around Atlanta that I have ever experienced.
So, Maurice, before we get into all the complications surrounding the Olympics, it's important to note that in light of all these doubts that people may have had from outside the city of Atlanta, Atlanta can proudly say they proved the critics wrong.
Of course. And as I think through this, there was when Atlanta hosted the Democratic National Convention in 1988 and the world was able to see the city get ready to host that kind of limelight, there were numerous conversations around what Atlanta had become. I mean, you know, it was the American dream where, you know, white business, where African-Americans had been able to, you know, get along with white business. And it was all of these different things. But the idea that Atlanta wins the games and the fact that Muhammad Ali, which was extremely strategic, that he lights the torch, which situates this idea of an actual physical fighter that had fought for civil and human rights, which is a continuation, again, of Dr. King's dream and the city. I mean, Dr. King is Atlanta's most beloved son, native son. And so Atlanta did prove many wrong in terms of pulling off that feat. But they did so by paying attention to some other Olympic cities, Los Angeles in particular, and Peter Uberoth's privatization of, you know, Olympic movements and things of that nature.
Yeah, they paid with a lot of private dollars.
Oh, yes.
It was considered the most commercial Olympics ever, and it was criticized by everyone outside Atlanta.
Of course.
Because of that. So I want to play you a comment from Atlanta Mayor Bill Campbell, and this is from an interview that you did with Mr. Campbell, and you were asking him about whether or not the Olympics helped to fly in the face of the stereotype that Atlanta was not safe, and here is his answer.
I don't think the popular perception of people that come to Atlanta is that it is an unsafe city. I think quite the contrary. I think people understand that most of the crime happens in fairly congested areas and pockets of poverty, as it does in every other city around this country.
Was safety a big topic of discussion and concern at the time that you were covering it?
It was, and I think the mayor was doing his duty in trying to minimize.
He's spinning it.
He is. And at the time, it was like, wow, at downtown Atlanta, where the Centennial Olympic Park used to be, was a very an area that was considered not very...
It was seedy.
Yeah, exactly. Not a good place to go down after dark, for sure.
Right. But to add to that, to prove that crime was a problem, in 1986-87, the mayor's council created the Red Dog Police, which was an elite drug agency that was to really clean up the city so that Atlanta could host the Democratic National Convention of 1988, which was the dress rehearsal for the Olympics. And so they created an elite task force that would clean up the drugs and crime. And so that shows there that crime was a blight on the city. And they had the Red Dogs had a major role all the way until, you know, the mid-2000s, 2005 or so.
Also, Techwood homes were razed, and mm-hmm. that was a big crime area.
Yes.
And the way they resolved that was they said, we're going to take down this public housing project and make it a mixed income project, and that is going to solve it.
There were also numerous low-income and poor people that were displaced as a result of it.
Yeah.
Also, Atlanta created a 56,000 square foot, 1,000 bed jail. That was the first Olympic project that was built on time and under budget to make sure that
the jail was the first project that was completed.
The first major project, and they put it down on Peachtree. And so, and the thing about it is they even separated the jail to where the left side was for, you know, federal offenders and the right side were for state offenders. And so that shows that there's a real issue in terms of policing the people.
Kathy Lohr is a former NPR correspondent who covered the 1996 Summer Olympics. The voice you just heard is Maurice Hobson. He's author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. They will stick around as we look at how the Olympics changed race relations in Georgia's capital city and whether they changed for the better or for the worse.
My name is Catherine Seacrest, and I'm born and raised in Kilmer Park, Atlanta, Georgia. I'm not sure I would want Atlanta to host the Olympics again. I'm not entirely sure how all of the building and construction was funded in 96, whether taxpayers paid for that or if we got federal subsidies. So if it's going to cost the Atlanta resident a lot of money to fund that, I am not in favor. And if it also means, again, a huge displacement of people who live in neighborhoods and have been there forever, if that's repeated, I wouldn't approve of that either. Kind of forced gentrification and beautification, it feels disingenuous.
Would you want to see Atlanta host another Olympic Games? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can tweet us at OST Talk. This is On Second Thought. Relics of the 96 Olympic Games can be found all over the city. You've got the Olympic Torch Tower that you can see from I-75. It towers over the downtown freeway, the World Athletes Monument, and of course, Centennial Olympic Park. Those are the physical reminders of how the city's landscape changed during the Olympics. But how did it change Atlanta's cultural and racial landscape? My guests this morning have some thoughts on this. Kathy Lohr is a journalist who covered the 1996 Games for NPR. Maurice Hobson is an assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University and author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. So, Maurice, what did Atlanta have to prove at this point to Atlantans? Because maybe the out from outside the borders, mm-hmm. people thought Atlanta had surpassed it. People within the borders did not.
Well, this is the thing, and this goes into what we call interracial class conflict. And so interracial class conflict looks at the black elite and black and middle class and juxtaposes them with the black working classes and poor. And when we get into this kind of conversation, because Atlanta boasts such a large black population, particularly within the city, the actual city, you know, hovering anywhere from 55% to 60%, what we begin to understand here is that with the Olympics and with the implementation of affirmative action that Mayor Maynard Jackson pushed, where he gave 35% of all city contracts to minority contractors, this produced a lot of minority millionaires, particularly black millionaires. And so as a result of it, many within Atlanta's black communities saw Atlanta as being unique for particular people in terms of a particular educational background.
What does that mean?
Well, in 1990, when Atlanta won the bid, Atlanta was the most violent city in the United States, the most crime-ridden city in the United States. And so what we begin to see here are tensions within communities that are not necessarily seen outside of those communities. And this is very prevalent, particularly within Atlanta's black community, whereas the working classes and poor felt as if they got nothing from the Olympics, whereas there are a group of educated African Americans that were really able to take part in the production of the Olympics.
Let's hear from Salitha Parker. This is someone you spoke with, Kathy, and she's talking about how the Olympics brought money into the inner city neighborhoods, as Maurice is there discussing.
Well, you know, I'm kind of happy that it came to Atlanta, but I'm like, gosh, they fixed up the city so well, it seemed as if they should have been digging, if you ask me, but it's nice.
Seems like they should have done it before.
Yeah, they should have been did it.
What kind of things did you see in terms of cultural changes in the city over the course of preparing for the Olympics and the Olympics moving forward? Because, again, Atlanta was welcoming an international community.
I think it was clear that there were still two Atlanta is in the city. Mm-hmm. There were the areas that received a lot of money, a facelift, if you will, a big, expensive facelift, even areas where trees were planted and sidewalks were bricked in, and besides a Centennial Park. And then there were areas that were really left out and had been thought they were going to get this same kind of facelift and actual, not just that, but business to come in. Salitha, that I interviewed, she was among the regular folks who said, gosh, this is a nice thing that they've done. So why wasn't anybody working on something like this previously? Why did it take the Olympics for somebody to focus on some of these poorer neighborhoods, Techwood, for example, that was thought of as one of the most dangerous parts of the city, mm-hmm. and was cleaned up by simply raising the whole project and then rebuilding something else on the side.
So tell me about the building of Olympic Village and what kind of decisions were made in terms of where to house all of the athletes.
Well, it was clear that the athletes were going to be housed in some predominantly area that could be controlled by the whites, mm-hmm. and not, for example, at among the black colleges. And yeah. I think there was a sort of a decision made with many people not being happy that maybe Morris Brown wasn't hosting the athletes.
Well, there was actually an actual movement for Olympic Village to be hosted at the Atlanta University Center, but the consortium of schools could not get themselves together.
The Atlanta University Center at the heart of the historically black colleges and
exactly.
universities.
And we have to think about Atlanta's notoriety. The political economy of Atlanta in terms of tourism is African-American heritage. Like, that's one of the major pieces of it. So, I mean, that's how the city is marketed. And so the historically black colleges could not work it out to where they could host Olympic Village. And as a result of this, the University System of Georgia put forth about $160 million to provide housing. And there was some hope, particularly amongst the homeless task force in the city, that that housing would become low-income housing for the homeless in the city. However, they eventually became dorms. I mean, they initially, after the games, they were dorms for Georgia State, and then they transitioned over to being dorms for Georgia Tech.
By the time I got here, though, in 1996, it was already...
It was done.
It was done. The deal was done, and mm-hmm. all you heard of is, wow, why didn't the Atlanta University Center have more involvement in this?
If you're just joining us, my guests are Maurice Hobson, author of a forthcoming book about Atlanta's Olympic Games, and journalist Kathy Lohr. This brings us, Kathy, then to your coverage of the 15th anniversary of the Olympics. And I wonder if people still even connect this conflict, maybe not a conflict, but argument over where to house the athletes with the Olympics anymore. I mean, this was a big news and it was a big topic of discussion at the time. But 15, 20 years on, do people still think of that?
I don't think most people in Atlanta would think about it or talk about it or reflect on it. I think for the people who live, though, surrounding Turner Field, the stadium, which was the Olympic Park, their stadium, they are the ones that are left with, gosh, what happened here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why weren't we more involved?
So, Maurice, then what do we take away from the successes and the failures of the Olympics, especially in terms of a city that had political leaders and many business leaders who were African American? I want to play you this clip from Andrew Young,
sure.
Who, of course, was co-chairman of the Atlanta Committee for the Olympic Games. He's defending here the city's handling of the Olympics. In specific, he's defending the handling of transportation issues.
We're good. We're damn good, in fact. We brought in 2,000 buses from all over the country, so some of them didn't know where they were going. What do you expect? We got the 2,000 buses. We didn't have to buy them. We will not mortgage the city and leave it in debt for one big, showcase.
To what extent was the Olympics an example of what African-American leadership can accomplish?
Well, and this is an important question. The critique of Ambassador Young as mayor of Atlanta is that he had no respect for the cultural history of Atlanta, particularly in terms of preservation.
Because it was so commercialized.
Because it was so commercialized. And so that's one of the critiques of it. But the thing about Atlanta and the Olympics was this. The city franchised for world consumption and was on the world stage, and people thought about how great it was. But there was another conversation going on in the underbelly of the city. What we begin to see are the most vulnerable populations are further criminalized, demonized, and disfranchised. And so we begin to see, you know, new ordinances that were passed in the city where homeless people were incarcerated or given a one-way bus ticket to leave town.
And some of that happened prior to the Olympics getting here to get the population under control, the homeless population. And the other thing that happened is when I neighborhoods around the stadium, Pittsburgh and Mechanicsville, those areas are still abandoned, basically. Even when the housing was built, sort of nice housing and in that area, it was lived in for a few years. People tried to flip the homes, and then they became abandoned. And it is a very sad story.
For
those areas, and that are still kind of waiting now that we're at the precipice of, okay, this land has been, you know, sold. It's going to, something else is going to happen here. I think there are a lot of people who are still reluctant, saying that's what they told us before.
But then we often hear, and I bet you guys will both agree, that the Olympics changed the culture of Atlanta, possibly forever.
Yes.
You say yes. Well, how did it change?
I'll give you a different perspective on it in this capacity. These things cost money. And when investors invest money, they're not doing it to be charitable. They're looking to get return on investment. But that leaves particular people out. And so, I mean, we sit on the fence with this. I mean, it does some great things, but it also has an underbelly. And so the conversations around the Confederate battle flag and how that was hidden during the Olympics, because progressive Olympians around the world said, we're not going to go to a city where they fly a racist flag.
And that was 20 years ago.
Right. And we're still dealing with that, because as recent, you know, as March, when, you know, Governor Deal strikes down the Georgia Religious Freedom Bill, it's the same kind of discrimination and the ability to generate capital in the city that can influence policy. That's political economy. And so the thing about it is, particularly for the city of Atlanta, is the Olympics did allow for Atlanta to attract a different demographic to come to the city, because it did position it as the South's newest premier world-class city.
And that really did, it brought a lot of middle-class blacks to Atlanta.
That's right.
The population was 3.5 million.
Right.
Today it is coming to
six million.
million,
and expected to grow by several million more.
Right.
But it brought a lot of middle-class whites back into the city.
Yes.
And what we have to understand about this is that oftentimes middle-class blacks from other places are very different than Atlantans or ATLians, as they call them, as locals, and particularly in terms of Atlanta's black old guard, the black elite and middle class, and then you have the working class and poor. So you have numerous interlopers that come into the city.
Yeah, it shuffled the deck.
And it shuffled the deck, but then it presents Atlanta to the rest of the world as if it's not really a southern city, it's more of a cosmopolitan city, when it actually is a real big country town.
Kathy Lohr is a former NPR correspondent. Maurice Hobson is assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University. We'll continue this conversation and consider what Atlanta's identity is today. Do the 96 games still play a role in how we define ourselves? This is On Second Thought. The 1996 Olympics gave the city of Atlanta 2.5 weeks of athletic competition and entertainment and exposure. Today we celebrate the 20th anniversary of the start of the Games. Let's continue this look back with former NPR correspondent Kathy Lohr and Maurice Hobson. Maurice is author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. Let's talk about the stadium. I feel like we need to tackle this because there is so much emotion tied up in the building of the stadium, so much pride in it, and of course, that's been revived as we abandoned. So let's go back to April of 1997. This is Braves president Stan Kasten. Olympic Stadium was converted into a 50,000-seat baseball stadium at that point, and it became Turner Field.
Never forget, for all the future years, that we are able to enjoy this stadium. We are so proud to have done this in the city of Atlanta without one penny of taxpayer money.
Kathy, at that point, when Stan Kasten was speaking, the commercialization was not an issue at that point. At that point, the fact that they had been able to pay for the Olympics mostly through private money was a huge point of pride, was it not?
It was. And the fact that they were able to use this venue in an ongoing
manner.
Retrofit. Yes, repurpose. And I think that people were happy about that. And at that time, it was still, oh, this is going to bring more business here. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen. And I will say that it's just been these neighborhoods have just been sort of hit time and time again with this idea that, wow, we've got the best thing going down here. And what they end up with is vacant parking lots.
This is a consistent problem with stadiums, no matter where you build them in the United States. But Maurice, talk to me a little bit about now how we are to view Turner Field and why there's so much emotion over the Braves moving.
First and foremost, there are imaginary lines around race in the city. And historically,
what does that mean?
So historically, anything south of Ponce was always considered to be black. I mean, that's just de facto segregation. But in modern times, it's anything south of I-20. And so, you know, the fact that Olympic Stadium and subsequent Turner Field was put into the Summerhill community really spoke to the idea that the city was really going to try to invest in terms of, you know, bringing things. However, the interesting component of it is that, of course, I'm sure you heard Georgia State recently won the bid for whatever that property is going to be.
Whatever it may become.
$300 million.
Yes.
Right. Investment.
Right. And so what that actually means is that now Georgia State has taken on the onus of putting life back into downtown Atlanta, probably trying to create some kind of campus town or something of that nature. But it's a hurtful thing that the Atlanta Braves would move to this new stadium in Cobb, and the statement was made to so that they could be closer to their fan base. And we're talking about north of the city. We're talking about going towards deep into Cobb County, and that is very precise language. So what has been said is downtown Atlanta is again, seedy, or to some extent it has been racialized in terms of meaning that, you know, this is an area that people feel unsafe, whereas, you know, going to Cobb presents something else.
And it was way different during the Olympic Games.
Of course.
One of my most vivid memories is going to that stadium for the track and field competition and walking under the Olympic rings, which are huge
right.
and still there in the middle
yeah.
of the street. The other old stadium, which was going to be torn down, was still in the backdrop.
Fulton County
Stadium. And just, it was a party. The plaza, it was clean.
Mm-hmm.
It was as if someone scrubbed up the place. And if you go there today, it's gone.
Yeah.
That vision, that feeling of pride, it's just not there.
Okay, well then let's continue on this theme because WBUR spoke with former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin, and I'm going to ask you, Kathy, how much of this has been and is not. But she believes the Olympics actually helped all the poor neighborhoods.
The Olympics is one of those periods, a five-year period, when people from all backgrounds decided that they were going to do what was right, not just to host great games, but right by the folks who lived in some of the lowest-income communities.
Is she right?
It's a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. I will say that some areas did see great improvements Techwood area is one of them, and Georgia Tech with the dorms and Georgia State. But the problem that has existed as long as I've been in Atlanta, which is now 20 years, is this area around what was Olympic Stadium. As long as I've been going down reporting, people have said there's nothing here. We were promised everything for the Olympics, and really nothing materialized. They don't have a grocery store. Businesses, they were supposed to get fancy restaurants and small time restaurants. And some of those things, restaurants came, but then they left.
Right. Maurice, how do lower income neighborhoods and the people who have been here for 20 years view the Olympics?
Dorothy Bolden, a community organizer and labor organizer here in the city, who helped to found the National Domestic Workers Association, was one of the major she was extremely critical of Atlanta winning the Olympics. And what she began to realize is that none of this would benefit the poor. There's a conversation around the Olympic ring. So the Olympic ring was an imaginary line that was created around the city. And the thing about it is because Maynard Jackson, who was a primary proponent of affirmative action, and Andrew Young understood that they could not go into the black community if they sold them down the river, those two really worked hard to get some of the benefits for the neighborhoods that fell into the Olympic ring. However, many low-income people, particularly African-Americans, saw the Olympics as an opportunity to seize the downtown area, to take downtown Atlanta back.
This has become part of the cultural landscape
That's
of Atlanta.
Right.
And I want to play you another comment from former Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin, who, again, worked on the 1996 Olympic Organizing Committee. And she is speaking here with WBUR about how we remember the Olympics here.
You know, I don't know anyone in Atlanta who didn't think the Olympics were good. Were they perfect? No. But I don't know anyone who thought it was bad for Atlanta.
Is that, Maurice, where we come down? That on the whole, look, no event of this size is ever going to be perfect.
Right.
But at the end of the balance sheet, Atlanta came out ahead?
For some, Atlanta did come out ahead, but
Are you separating, and I want to make sure I understand your terms here. Are you talking about Atlanta as a city entity? Or are you talking about Atlanta, the people who make it up?
We're talking about two different entities, of
yeah.
course. We're talking about the commercial branding of Atlanta, which
yes.
is a presentation, an image that is presented. That made out wonderfully.
I think that was hugely successful.
Yeah. That Atlanta's greatest feat is boosterism. The fact that it can show itself as being big and bad. And that entity made out greatly. But the people that made up Atlanta, they were left wanting. And so I sit on the fence because there are some positive things that came out of it in terms of situating Atlanta as an international city, which, you know, in other terms, you know, opened up transportation opportunities from the busiest and biggest airport in the world mm-hmm. to fly all around the world, which connects Atlanta. I mean, you can fly anywhere in the world from this airport, you know, to a larger extent. So that did put Atlanta in the game. And so what we have here are the businesses that made out greatly, but the people suffered.
My guests are Maurice Hobson, author of the forthcoming book about Atlanta's Olympic Games, and journalist Kathy Lohr. Kathy, as Atlanta prepares for another big event, and I'm talking about the Super Bowl, mm-hmm. how has the city changed? What's left over from hosting the Olympics, for example, that might either help us or hurt us as we move toward the Super Bowl?
I think Atlanta can no doubt host big events, mm-hmm. and people know how to do that.
And there's no more doubts anymore.
Mm-hmm. No, and
no
nobody would question that. I think the new stadium, the Super Bowl would not have happened without the new stadium.
That's
but
right.
what it continues to show is that Atlanta tears down its history. And that's, you know, something's 20 years old. It's a relic. Let's bring in the new. And that's also part of Atlanta. Atlanta was this phoenix rising from the ashes.
That's
and
right.
this sort of relic of being burnt down from the Civil War. And it wants new, shiny. And I think that's what it gets. That's what perpetuates. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it does leave what is our history.
It may present the city as a faddish city, you know, always with the current trends. Whereas, you know, if you travel internationally and you go to Rome and you visit the Colosseum or you visit particular museums, you know, Atlanta always has the current, but it doesn't always have a past. And in terms of public history and preservation, that presents a unique situation in terms of how things are preserved and remembered.
That's Maurice Hobson. He's assistant professor of African American Studies at Georgia State University, author of the forthcoming book, The Legend of the Black Mecca, Myth, Maxim, and the Making of an Olympic City. And Kathy Lohr is a former NPR correspondent. Thanks so much to both of you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.